Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, June 22nd, 2026. My name is Magnus Thiewald. Joining me in the studio today
is Peter R. H.
And we've got a good show lined up for you today. So thanks for tuning in and joining us today. We're starting off the show with an interview about whales. We've been seeing a lot of whales in our local area here, including all the way into places like False Creek and Burrard Inlet. I even saw the whales from a sea bus a little while back. We're going to be talking to UBC researcher Taryn Scarfe about what's going on with whales and why we're seeing so many of them in our area. And you'll also hear a bit about how you can perhaps get out and see some whales yourself. We have Gardening with Embark. We're going to be talking to Pablo Vimas, our gardens expert, and taking a tour of the Embark gardens here on campus and talk about some of the different setups they have there.
What about the tomatoes? You're supposed to do something about tomatoes last week. What happened to that story?
Well, there was a technical problem and something happened.
You're never going to get that. I'm going to talk about tomatoes in my segment.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about the legality of that of the late 19th century court case, plus the one about the person from New Brunswick who was getting the Quebec alcohol and bringing it across.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about that. The sovereign citizen movement, and here in Canada with free men in the land. And actually, there's a third entity. It is called DTAX. And that 20 years ago, I went to some of those meetings.
Right. So we're going to hear. Interesting.
Yeah.
On the topic of tomatoes, we will get back to tomatoes because tomatoes are an important topic for gardeners because so many people grow tomatoes, but that'll be in a show in a couple of weeks or so.
If I can just bring back what I was hearing on the last show.
Sure.
Because
if you've just tuned in, the show before us is Guerrilla Radio, which is, I think, produced at the station, the campus station at UVic in Victoria. And, of course, it airs every week here.
So I live on directly west of Lougheed Mall. They got these three towers. They're directly west of the parking lot and directly north of Lougheed Highway. So I'm close by, and I have my radio that I hear that show coming up here.
Yeah.
So I heard the show. Now, what I think they were a bit convoluted about was you never know what side these guys are on. Like you heard the bit of the end, Magnus.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of muddled. It's like, are they trying? I mean, here's what I think was muddled about the end argument. They're saying, well, the Canadian government is going towards the Americans. But then they say, well, the American, Donald Trump made a proposal to Putin that they thought was a good agreement. And then it's like, oh, well, we're going counter to that. And they're muddled. I think their whole thinking is a bit muddled. And the host, he didn't make it clear whether he thought this guy was going a bit off the rails. He said, well, that's interesting, and I got a banana on my hat or something. I don't know what the hell they were. And the other thing that I disagree on past shows was Venezuela under Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
The chickens were going to come to roost if he had lived. It isn't because they got the other person that they had. I mean, he was handling that entire economy by himself. Like, there's a Who did Platoon? Who's that director? Oliver Stone.
Yep.
Oliver Stone kind of did a documentary in Venezuela when they had Hugo Chavez. And he goes, oh, I study all night. Look at all the books. Well, you don't have to study all night because you have a team of people. He was handling the economy all by himself. And then he would go on, you know, his TV broadcast for 4 hours some days. You know, I mean, and Castro did the same thing. Alvar Stone actually did a thing on Castro. He said, oh, I'm trapped by my people. I have to. And he had to run around his desk for exercise, supposedly. This is not how Franklin Roosevelt handled himself, even though there were a bit of problems with him, actually. Mm-hmm. It was Harry Truman who stopped the public sector from being not allowing blacks to be employed by the United States government. So, I mean, I'm not saying Franklin Roosevelt was everything about him was good, but he was certainly better than like Hugh Chavez. Anyway, that's a comment on the show previous to ours, which is still worth hearing.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's an interesting show. I find myself disagreeing with a lot of what they have to say. I think it's an interesting show in the sense that it provides a very different perspective than most other media does. And, in my personal opinion, sometimes I think they're different for, doesn't mean better. I mean, I think, and you probably know this too, that, you know, there's always a certain... always been a certain segment of the left, and you could say the really activist left, whose guiding principle, among other things, is anti-Americanism. They're opposed to whatever the Americans are doing. And sometimes when you talk to folks like that, you know, that perspective pervades everything to the point where it becomes a dominant, well, the Americans are doing this and pushing this way, so we think the opposite, and anyone who opposes them must be on our side.
Yeah, but these guys even go one further, or the guest they had, he said he likes part of what Donald Trump is doing and not another part. So he contradicted himself.
Well,
you know what I'm talking about? You know, he liked that Trump made a deal with Putin. And then he says, oh, there was the Americans, and it was convoluted. It was like it contradicted itself.
Yeah, and there's a lot of oddball framing that Europe supporting Ukraine is characterized as attacking Europe. And Russia attacking Ukraine is defined as defending themselves. There's a bit of, what's the term from Orwell?
Doublethink.
Doublethink going on there, and that, you just rearrange the words to make it mean whatever you describe any event or situation or historical context.
Man, I like this talk.
And I just wanted to bring up one more point. Just, the final point he made on the program was about, the West and Canada have no anti-fascist credentials. The Soviet Red Army was the biggest force in defeating the Germans, which is true. In many ways is very true, but you also have to remember that the Russians actually formed an agreement and then collaborated with the Germans, the Nazis, to conquer Poland.
Yes, that's right.
When Germany invaded Poland to start the war,
right?
They already had a pact with the Russians, and the Russians rolled
That's
over
right.
the border from the other side and occupied half of Poland.
What I was going to
say. So who's collaborating with who? Go ahead,
Peter. Anyway, briefly on that, it's that the 1939 New York World's Fair had the Soviets part of it until they made the pact. So in September or whatever, they weren't there. And when they returned for 1940, the last year of that particular New York World's Fair, it was the Avenue of the Americans or something.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one last thing I like to say is that there is a really good show on Thursdays from 9 to 10 on this station called the Canadian Philosophy Show. It's by philosophy students, I think, from Nanaimo. It's from that thing. And it's a good show. I just thought I hear it.
Yeah.
I just thought to say that.
All right.
And one thing about the whale thing, supposedly they have like a frontal lobe, like humans, dolphins, and so they could be more intelligent than us, but they got no opposable thumb. They're in water. They can't make fire.
Well,
so
let's come back to that after the interview. I just wanted to say also, you know, in the news this weekend was the beginning of negotiations between the U.S. and Iran in Switzerland with the help of Pakistan. And all I can say is after the first weekend, I'm confused about everything that went on there. Supposedly it went well, but also the Iranians walked out. Trump threatened to bomb them again. But supposedly it went well. So who knows how it went.
Okay.
Anyway, it'll be interesting to see how far that process gets before it all entirely breaks down. But who knows? Maybe if we're lucky, it'll be successful.
So we're going to have that whale thing. And I'll say a few things about that afterwards.
Yeah. So we've seen, as I said in our introduction to the show, we've seen a lot of whales in our area, into False Creek, into Burrard Inlet, just off the shores of Stanley Park and in English Bay. And there's a reason for that. And researchers at UBC have been tracking whales for quite a while. And I talked to Taryn Scarf of UBC on Friday, and she told us a whole lot more about this. So here's our interview. Joining me now is Taryn Scarf from UBC's Department of Zoology and a master's researcher looking at whales. How long have you been interested in whales, and how long have you been professionally studying them?
It's a great question, actually. I think I've loved whales for my whole life. I'm from a small town in BC where we don't have an ocean, but I would always come to Vancouver to visit my grandparents and see the whales here. And that's kind of where my love for them started. And I was fortunate enough during my undergraduate degree at UBC to work on a research project with the Marine Mammal Research Unit, starting to look at resident killer whales. And that was 7 years ago at this point. So back in 2019 was when I started. And I've just kind of continued on since then.
And so for your master's research, you've been looking at whales and their movements around the area. Can you tell me a bit more about what you were researching?
Yeah. So for my master's, I was looking at the abundance and distribution of transient killer whales. So those are the mammal-eating killer whales, around Vancouver. So anywhere from as far south as like Victoria all the way up to Port Hardy area. So looking at how many whales are spending time in this area, when are they spending the most time here, and how does that kind of link up with the prey that's available to them?
Right. So we've been seeing quite a number of whales right around our area recently, and different ones too, orcas and grays and humpbacks, all sort of near to Vancouver, which I don't, certainly in my experience living here, I mean, they come and go all the time, but it seems like there's a lot of them lately. What's been happening?
Yeah, there's so many more whales coming around Vancouver. So with the transient killer whales, I feel like there's a report at least once a week now, especially in the last month or so, of whales being seen under the Lionsgate Bridge, going up Burrard Inlet, in around English Bay. I mean, they'll come that close to the city, but then there's so many more just off in the Strait of Georgia as well, right? For the transient killer whales in particular, it's mainly more seals and sea lions for them to eat in this area, especially like heading up Burrard Inlet. There's a lot of harbor seal populations up there, so they've kind of figured out that's the hot spot to eat. The population itself is growing of the whales, so there's more whales. So we're just seeing a lot more of them here. For the gray whales, that's a more like new thing, especially for us in this area. Yeah, it's pretty rare for gray whales to actually come in this far towards a city, and kind of off their normal migration route. Down in Puget Sound, there is a local population that will spend some time there. But it's mainly just to come and feed on all the different species that we have in the area. So coming this close to shore, I mean, there's been so much cool footage of people being able to see the gray whale off of like Kitts Beach, which is super cool. And then with the humpbacks, there's just a rebound in their population. So they're doing really great. This is a traditional feeding ground for them, and they're just starting to come back in really big numbers, which is great to see year after year.
One of the things I sort of mentioned in an article was how at one point the humpback population was almost entirely wiped out on this coast, and there's sort of a theory that maybe with that happening, the knowledge, the community knowledge with the whales was kind of lost of where the good hunting grounds were.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, back when whaling was still happening in Canada, the humpback population took a big hit during that time. And this used to be a traditional feeding ground for them. And so it's good to see them coming back here and finding new areas as well. I mean, they're kind of finding all these different little pockets of hot spots for food throughout the Salish Sea and moving more northwards as well now.
Well, I imagine a river estuary sort of would, like a big one like the Fraser, would sort of tend to be a good spot for all the whales, for all their sort of prey foods.
Totally, yeah. It's a great spot for all their prey foods. And then in the case of the transients, the prey that they eat, right? So that's, the Fraser is like a hot spot for all the different salmon species coming back, which the harbor seals love to feed on. And the transients have picked up on this. So that's why they're coming back to feed on those growing harbor seal populations.
So, I mean, part of what we're talking about here is, you know, we're seeing more whales and some rebounding populations, but whale populations are also under stress as well. I mean, we've just another report, I think it was last week, of a humpback, you know, emaciated humpback washing up on the shore. And obviously, and that's been happening for a few years where it appears they're not getting enough food. And we hear about the resident orca population also struggling. How do these, you know, these sort of two sort of trends balance out, or what's happening?
It's really depends on what they eat, it seems to be, and the population of whales. So like in the example of the killer whales, we have the transients, who are the mammal-eating population, who are flourishing right now. There's more than 350 individuals in the population. They're growing. And I think because of what they eat, they have a pretty diverse menu from what they can pick from. Yeah. They're doing really well, whereas especially the southern resident population, they're a very small population, only in the 70s, I believe. Like their numbers fluctuates in the low 70s. But they're a fish-eating population. So they're fully dependent, especially in the summer months, primarily on Chinook salmon. Not as much of that to go around potentially. Their menu isn't as diverse as the transients, so they're a little bit more limited in what they're willing to eat, which makes it difficult. And when a population's already struggling, they're kind of a little bit more susceptible to other threats, whereas the transients, since they have so much to eat, they can just prey on anything. Similar with like the gray whales, I think they're one of the populations that's been being the ones found super emaciated and washing up on shore. And it's also, I believe, a food issue for them. And that's kind of why they're coming into this area. They need to restore those fat reserves and eat some more because they're not able to make it the full way. Which is concerning for sure. So it's, different menu items that they all eat really dictates how well the population does.
With the killer whales, I mean, they tend to be really social animals. They live in family groups and pods and stuff. So is the difference in their food preference? I mean, could that be described as a cultural issue almost? And I'll let you answer that question first and then follow up.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I mean it's I mean they the two populations of killer whales diverged many, many, many years ago and don't really have much genetic similarity between the
Okay.
two. And it is cultural, physiological potentially as well, just in what was available. But like they don't interbreed between the two populations. And even in BC, we have the southern residents who are really struggling, have that low population number, but we also have the northern residents who kind of stay in the area of like Campbell River northward, and their population's doing pretty well. So they have a few hundred individuals in their population, but they also don't mix with the southern residents. And so they're very three separate groups who it would be great if they like genetically would breed
Right.
together, but they all stay in their own areas.
Because I guess my next question was going to be if they could, one population could sort of learn from the other, but if they're not really even mixing it up, maybe that's not very likely.
Yeah, they avoid each other at all costs, really. There's very little observations of them overlapping at the same time and being seen in the same area at the same time. So it would be difficult, and there's a lot of cultural and specializations that they've just been focused on that one food source for a long time.
How do current populations for all these whales today, how do they compare to what we understand and know about historical populations, particularly before Europeans showed up on the coast and started doing hunting and anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, for the transient killer whales, they historically have been known to be in this area. So that's a lot of the indigenous communities around Vancouver have shared stories of transient killer whales coming up into Burrard Inlet. So we're almost seeing, the rebalancing from the past, essentially, of having these populations come in post-colonization. Which is really cool to see. So, like the orca whale really plays a significant role in Indigenous communities, and yeah, there's lots of stories of whales coming up Burrard Inlet, in particular with the killer whales, both residents and transients as well.
Okay. So what I know, what do we need to do, as residents here, but also our government at both levels, to support these populations? I know some stuff has been done around ship traffic to try and limit that impact on whales. What are the things that need to happen to help these, particularly, I mean, I don't know what can be done to help the southern resident population recover, but for all the populations.
Yeah, there's kind of two veins. We have like the one where the whale populations are doing pretty well. So like the transient killer whales, the northern resident killer whales, humpback populations now. So I think the focus for them is making sure we keep their populations healthy. So making sure that they have enough food sources available, whether that's through like making sure there's abundant harbor seal and sea lion populations and other marine mammal species, as well as fish availability. So making
Reporting
sure that
from
there's enough
Vancouver,
fish for the
BC.
humpbacks to prey on. And then for the residents, like the other vein where we have these struggling populations more. So we have the southern resident killer whales and then the gray whales who are showing up emaciated. I think a lot more research really needs to go into figuring out what is the exact root cause. I don't think in any population there's one specific reason that is leading to the struggles in these populations. There's probably a number of things. So figuring out what those things are, and then, like you mentioned, acting on them. So how there was some vessel traffic reductions, the government just put in place, where vessels have to stay even farther from whales now. So measures like that really help, looking at how sound impacts them, and then of course the food availability. So taking a look at all the different factors that could potentially be negatively impacting these populations, and finding a solution for them while also ensuring that we keep the healthy populations healthy.
So people love to see whales. And people get so excited, when the opportunity comes up. What are some tips for how to find them and how to do it safely?
Yeah, I also love seeing whales. I have also lived in Vancouver for many years now, and I've never been able to see a killer whale very close to Vancouver. Mine have been more towards Vancouver Island, but if you're one of the lucky ones, it's a really great experience. So if you're going to be on land, there's a few key areas where they like to go. So like I mentioned, they've been traveling up Burrard Inlet the last month or so. That seems to be a bit of a hot spot for them, especially we're coming into the summer months. This is when they're here the most, and we have the most individuals available or present in the area. So your chances of seeing one are the highest through the summer months. So going through up in Burrard Inlet, off Lighthouse Point in West Vancouver is often where people will go, and you can also sometimes see the humpbacks off there. The humpbacks won't come up in towards Burrard Inlet as much. There is a land-based whale watching guide that was put out by the Orca Man, who's a local Vancouver resident, and that's a great solution to look at. And then if you think you are if you're on the water searching for whales, it's just to look for those spouts. That's the best way to see them, especially if they're at a far distance. You want to just see their blow come up into the air. And from there, you'll be able to kind of follow where they're going and track them.
The other trick is riding the ferry a lot.
I've been fortunate on a lot of the ferry rides. I've been able to see killer whales, especially, and humpbacks as well. And if you want a higher chance, ride the ferry a few times a day.
So you've finished your master's now. Are you hoping to continue working with whales?
So I'm working a lot more in fisheries work in BC. So I worked on a project after my master's looking at the how much salmon is available for the southern residents. So that'll be a paper coming out in the next year or so. And that kind of got me into the world of salmon and looking at fisheries work and how important the fisheries are as well for the whales. So continuing on with that and finishing up some of these ongoing projects.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Taryn Scarfe, who's a recent master's graduate from UBC's Department of Zoology and whale researcher.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for talking to me today.
Thanks to Taryn Scarfe for that interview. You had some things to say about whales, Peter.
Well, one thing I like to make clear are these False Creek, like you got Burrard Bridge, and eastward from Burrard Bridge and then Granville and Cambie, that's False Creek, right?
I don't know. I guess I think False Creek is everything. Yeah, from the Burrard Bridge inwards.
So we got whales in that area,
We
which is
have.
quite.
It's been reported in the
Okay.
media. It's not very nice water. I don't know why they'd want to go there, but
Well, I'm going to bring up a film from late 1973. I saw it in 1974. Day of the Dolphin. Did you see this? Do you even know about it?
No.
It was directed by Mike Nichols, who directed The
Okay.
Graduate, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and
And a lot of other serious cerebral
Who's
films.
Afraid of Virginia Woolf is the first restricted film. It changed the production code, ended. And in
And they
1968,
came up with a new
well, the United
classification.
States, they had, it was GP, it still is, GPG restricted. I think Midnight Cowboy 1969 got the X rating. And they said that's the first film that won an Academy Award. They got an X rating. But anyway, so actually, Day of the Dolphin was rated G. And it was sort of, in those days, they really made sure if you were a child, you couldn't see the movie. So there was Day of the Majackal. So I guess, I'm assuming it was to make something like we can't see as a child Day of the Jackal. We can see Day of the Dolphin. And it had George C. Scott in it. And here's, I'm just going to read a bit of the plot. A brilliant and driven scientist and his wife, along with their small team, are training dolphins to communicate with humans at remote island research facility. But they teach one dolphin they have raised in captivity for 4 years to speak simple English. Now then, here's the thing here, and I'm just going to do this pretty convoluted. After the dolphins are kidnapped, one of them reveals that the Franklin Institute is planning to further train the dolphins to carry out a political assassination using a magnetic limpid